Cruel and unusual punishment. And an economist says, do you really want armed robbers to routinely kill their victims? Because after all, if the punishment for armed robbery and the punishment for armed robbery plus murder are the same, the additional punishment for the murder is zero, and a dead man cannot identify you in a police lineup. Right, so that the economic approach consists of assuming that individuals are rational, including criminals, potential victims, tortfeasors, victims of torts, everybody else, and thinking of legal rules as incentives, saying, given these rules, how will people act? Let me give you a slightly different example of the economic approach. And that's the question of why criminal law requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt and civil law requires only proof by a preponderance of the evidence. And some people will say, well, the reason is that criminal penalties are more severe. But, of course, that isn't true. It's true that the most severe criminal penalty may be more severe than most civil penalties, but a tort suit for $1 million has more at stake than a criminal case which will put you in jail for a week, maybe even a suspended sentence. And the economist's answer, or an economist's answer, is that the tort punishment, so to speak, is a transfer of money. So if we get the wrong result in a tort case, if we have a too low a standard of proof, once in a while I pay you $1,000 that I shouldn't have, and once in a while you pay me $1,000 that you shouldn't have. On average, the society is poorer only by the wages you people are going to earn as lawyers. That is only by the costs of the suit, not by the amount of the punishment. On the other hand, if we convict the wrong person of murder, sometimes one person dies who shouldn't, sometimes another person dies who shouldn't. Those don't cancel. When an innocent person is executed, nobody gets the life he loses. Whereas when an innocent tort defendant loses, at least somebody gets the money he pays. So that would suggest, from an economist standpoint, that it makes sense to be more careful about inflicting criminal penalties than about inflicting tort penalties. This is part of a much longer question, which is why we have both criminal law and tort law and why they differ as they do. One of the talks I sometimes give is entitled, Should We Abolish the Criminal Law? As an attempt to look at the question of whether you could have a working legal system in which tort entirely swallowed crime, as it were. And it's especially interesting because there's a real-world society that did for about a third of a millennium, in which if you killed somebody, his kin sued you. But that would be another talk. Once we think about looking at law as an incentive system and saying how will it affect people's behavior, in deciding what legal rules we want, the obvious question is what outcomes do we want? What results do we want? A lot of the law and econ literature assumes a particular outcome, thanks largely to the influence of Judge Posner, who was one of the early important writers in the field. And Posner offered a conjecture, and that was that the best way of understanding the common law was that it was a set of rules as if designed to maximize what he calls wealth, what the rest of us call economic efficiency, and what is sometimes described as the size of the pie. You can think in some vague sense, which would take more time than I have here to explain, of saying, is a particular outcome result in people on the whole being better off? And Posner's conjecture was that common law was roughly the set of rules designed to produce that result. Posner also pretty clearly thought that was a good idea, but that's a separate, the question of what is the law is separate from what it should be. So a lot of law and econ work has gone to ask the question, what would be the efficient legal rule? What would be the legal rule that would in some sense maximize the size of the pie? But that's not really a defining feature of law and econ, because you could use the same tools to answer other questions. You could say, what would be the legal rules that would minimize income inequality? Or what would be the legal rules that would maximize life expectancy or some other objective? And from my standpoint, at least the essential feature of the economic approach to law is that we assume that people are rational. And we then ask, given this legal rule, what will happen? It's a way of understanding the consequence of legal rules. Let me give you a simple example, and this is within, really, Posner's approach, and that's tort law. The basic sort of simple sketch of tort law is I do something that wrongfully imposes costs on you, you sue me, and I must make you whole. And the economist says, aha, I know that. That's an idea that was invented by an economist called Pigou in the 1930s. And common law may have had it a little bit earlier than that. But the Pigou's basic argument was, suppose there's something I would like to do that imposes costs on other people. Something that benefits me at some cost to others. Well, a possible rule would be to say, I will have to pay an amount equal to the cost I impose on others if I do it. Think of it as a fine or a tax. Now, if even though I have to pay it, I still want to do it, if I have something which benefits me by $1,000, hurts other people by $100, and even after I'm told if you do it, you'll have to pay $100, I still want to do it, then that means that in some sense that act has net benefits. It benefits me by much more than it hurts others. And a sensible system will result in people being able to take acts that have net benefits. Tort law looks a lot like that. That tort law says, I do something which imposes a $100 cost on you. You're going to sue me, so I'm going to have to make it up. I'm going to have to make you as well off as if I hadn't done it. If even though I have to make you as well off as if I hadn't done it, I still want to do it, then it's providing a net benefit. Now, that's a very sketchy version, and if you think about it a little, you'll see there are a number of things that I've left out that make it not work as neatly as I've described it, but is at least a good sort of first approximation to tort law. Let me give you an entirely different example as a way of achieving the same objective, and that's property, the institution of private property. We have something, for example, this pocket knife, which I discovered after I got off the airplane, had been in a pocket of my jacket, and both I and security had missed it. I'm going to mail it back before I get back on the airplane. Suppose this pocket knife happens to be worth more to one of you than to me. Well, the private property rule is it belongs to me, but I can transfer it. So if it's worth more to you than to me, you'll be willing to make me an offer that I will accept. And thus, the basic property rule, which is things belong to people, but if it belongs to you, you can transfer it voluntarily to anybody else, means that things will tend to move to the person who values them the most. All right, that's a very, very, again, a very simple, sketchy picture of how property works. I should say another feature of the property rules, which also seems sensible, is that if you create something, it belongs to you. And thus, if the cost to someone of making this pocket knife is less than the value to somebody of having it, it'll be in someone's interest to make it. That's, again, a very sketchy view of what could be a lot more economics. So that suggests that tort law and property law are both ways of getting things, as it were, to their highest valued use, of getting people to make those decisions that produce net benefits. And that naturally raises a question, which is what decides which we use when? So that, for example, the ownership of cars is protected by a property rule. If I happen to need your car to get to the airport, so I break into the door, I hotwire the ignition, I drive off to the airport, I don't get to say, all right, sue me. You lost the use of the car for a day, and you had to do a few repairs on the door, so sue me for the damages. That's not how we handle the allocation of cars. The way we handle the allocation of cars is that you have a property right into it. If I want your car, I've got to make you an offer that you'll accept. And if I take your car without doing that, very bad things are supposed to happen to me, which will result in people not acting that way. All right, that's, again, a very simple, sketchy view of what property is. On the other hand, when I drive my car, I am imposing costs on other people because there is some low probability that I will skid and put a dent in your car or put a dent in you or not notice you crossing the street because I'm too busy arguing with the talk show radio host who I'm listening to at the moment and run you down. There are lots of things I could do to you, and most of those are handled by tort law. That for the most, in the most cases, if I do injure you through my driving, you do get to sue me and collect damages. You could imagine reversing this. You could imagine a legal system where I can steal your car any time I want. I just have to pay you damages for whatever I did to the car and for your lost use. And you could imagine a legal system where before I'm allowed to drive out my driveway, I first have to contract with all the people I might dent to pay them for their permission to impose a risk on them. All right, it's not logically impossible. It sounds like a pretty screwy way of doing it. And if you look at those examples, that suggests why we do it the way we do. Because what's wrong with my having to buy permission from everybody before I pull out of my driveway? What's wrong with that is that there are about a million of them, and signing a contract with all of a million people will employ an awful lot of lawyers for an awful long time and probably won't happen. All right. So a different way of putting it is that the transaction cost of using the property rule to allocate the right to impose small risks on people, which is what I'm describing, those transaction costs are very high. So we prefer to say we'll only deal with it if the risk actually eventuates, and then we have to go to court. Similarly, if you turn it around, if you allocated cars via tort law, it's not quite as impossible a system. On the other hand, it's going to be pretty hard to demonstrate to the court just what the cost to me was of having to find my car and not having it that day, and I'll claim that I had some really important appointment and so forth. And on the other hand, the transaction costs of allocating cars by property are very low. I can tell you this because I've got a car sitting two blocks from here that was allocated by property. I picked it up from the rental car place at the Tulsa airport evening before yesterday. Works very smoothly. So it's pretty clear that for allocating cars, it makes a lot more sense to use the property approach, which is you've got a more or less unlimited right to your car, but you're transferable. You can rent it to me or sell it to me. Whereas for allocating low probability risks, like the chance that I'll dent your car when driving, it makes a lot of sense to use tort law. All right. So that's sort of an interesting example, something we usually don't think about, which is why in our legal system we have these two rather different approaches to achieving the same objective, namely making sure that whoever values something most in effect gets to be the one who uses it. But this then gets to another question, and a question which economists especially should think about. And that is why things are property and why some things are not. That to the non-economist, there's a temptation to say, why have all these property rules anyway? Why not just say whoever needs something uses it? And the economist sees it the other way around. He says, property is just this wonderful, clever set of institutions which, in a decentralized fashion, with hundreds of millions of people, nonetheless coordinates human activity. Because if I need something to make something, I can buy it from whoever has it. If I need something created, the fact that I'm willing to buy it means other people find it and they're just created and so forth. It looks like just a lovely system. Economists think it's really great. And then the question is, well, in that case, should everything be property? All right. The non-economist is tempted to say nothing should be. The economist is tempted to say everything should be. And my standard counterexample is language. All right. Language, the English language, is an immensely valuable and very complicated piece of intellectual property. The meanings of the words, the rules of grammar, all of that represents, in a sense, the same sorts of things we have patents for. It would be a little hard to know for the whole thing who ought to own it, because it's been created over 1,000 years or so by a lot of people. But you could imagine a legal system which said anytime somebody creates a new word and gets it into use, he owns it. And other people can only use it with his permission. Now, there would be some advantage to this. It may have occurred to you that there is at least one serious defect in the English language, and that is the fact that it has no gender-neutral pronouns. So if I want to make a statement about somebody who might be male or female, my available choices are the old rule, which is to use he, and then the feminists get mad at me, the common cheat, in my view, which is to use they, and then everybody who sort of has an ear for the logic of the language, including me, says, no, 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 they is a plural. You can't say they is, and you shouldn't say they are when there's only one person. Or alternatively, you can say he, she, he or she, that's very clumsy. You can try to invent some new word which nobody's done successfully. Now, if only language were private property, some clever entrepreneur would think up a new extra set of pronouns which somehow worked, which, you know, fit people's ear. They sounded the way Ms. works. All right, Ms. is one which arose spontaneously for a similar problem, for somebody where you're not specifying married or unmarried woman, so call it Ms. Well, some clever person would think up an equivalent of that for he or she. and would spend millions of dollars putting it into circulation, paying soap operas to use it, all sorts of things, and would then sit back and retire on the revenue from being paid 15 cents every time anybody who spoke English used his new words. So there would be some advantage to propertizing the English language. On the other hand, if you imagine that before you speak any sentence, you first have to license all the words, you can see that it would be a very quiet world. All right? So that's a case where there are some benefits to making something private property, but the benefits are almost certainly less than the cost, again, because of the large transaction cost of organizing all of those tiny transactions in order to make it work. My next story on why things are sometimes property and sometimes not is my story of why we owe civilization to the dogs. And the story starts out about 10,000 years ago, some point early in the invention of agriculture. And I'm a member of a tribe which has been farming for a few generations. And it's a real pain. Because, you see, we're all socialists. Or maybe I should say communists. That is to say, the land belongs to the whole tribe. All of us cultivated, all of us planted, all of us weeded. And the result is that all of us spend at least half our time watching our neighbors. Are you doing your part of the work? Is he doing his part of the work? And when the crop comes in, wait a minute, you're taking too much. All right. And it occurs to me, clever fellow that I am, that I've got this wonderful solution to the problem. And the solution is called private property. And I suggest that we divide up the land, and each family has its plot of land, and each family is responsible for growing crops on that and get the crops they grow. And one of the wise elders of the tribe says, yeah, kid, it sounds great, but let me tell you, the tribe over the next hill tried that back when I was young, and you know what happened? Instead of spending all their time watching each other to make sure that they were doing their job, each property owner spent all of his time watching his field to make sure nobody else was harvesting it. That the time and effort that went into defending those property rules, that went into making sure that what I planted, I harvested, was even worse than the time and effort the way we're doing it, so we're going to keep doing it this way. All right. So it goes on for a few generations, and we're spending a lot of our time watching it, and then comes the breakthrough. The domestication of the dog. I think of it as the bionic burglar alarm. All right? Dogs are territorial animals. A dog can be trained to recognize his owner's territory as his territory, and now we can sleep soundly at night with a system of private property and land due to the fact that if a trespasser tries to harvest the crop we worked so hard to grow, our dog will alert us, maybe even bite the trespasser, and we can deal with that. So what that suggests is that even for a case like land, where on the face of it to moderns it seems obvious that private property and land is a sensible arrangement, whether it is a sensible arrangement depends on the costs of enforcing those rules and on the benefits. If you, under some circumstances, it's worth doing, some it isn't. Turns out that I started thinking about this because of an article by an economist who looked at various primitive societies. And some of them had private property and land and some of them didn't. And you're tempted to say, well, the ones that don't are too primitive to have thought about the idea. But it then turns out that some of them have private property and land part of the year. What's happening? Private property... Anybody know why this thing is making noise?
I heard it was like a tornado warning test, apparently.
Ouch. All right, then we can't do anything about it. All right, so... What's going on is that private property and land works pretty well for farming, especially if you've got dogs to act as burglar alarms. On the other hand, private property and land is a really bad idea if what you're mostly doing with land is hunting large animals across it. Because then, every time you come to a boundary, you've got to stop while the deer runs away and get permission to go on. So it makes sense to say, well, if part of the year we're growing crops and part of the year no crops are growing, but we're hunting, then we will have private property and land part of the year and not the other part. So that's, I think, a fairly nice... way of showing why, although private property is a very useful institution, it has its limits, and there are some things that shouldn't be private property. And the place where that gets immediately relevant to modern law is intellectual property law. Because, for example, we are much more willing to establish and defend property in the kind of things covered by copyright than property in the kind of things covered by patent. That, as you probably know, these notes are copyrighted. The reason they're copyrighted is that I printed them out. They know no other procedure is necessary under modern U.S. law. On the other hand, in order to get a patent on something, you have to go through a lengthy and elaborate process of convincing the relevant government office that indeed you meet, you've jumped all through all their hoops and meet all their criteria. And a patent doesn't last nearly as long as copyright. And why? I would argue that the reason that that makes sense is that copyrights, at least traditional copyrights, this is less true of some of the modern law where you copyright a lot of stuff that look more like patent. We just think of a copyright on a book. It is very unlikely that you will accidentally write the same book I wrote. So the problem of my reducing your options by copywriting what I've done doesn't exist there. Whereas with patent law, it's a fairly serious problem, because with patent law, somebody else might indeed make the same invention. Furthermore, copyright law is defining things which have nice sharp boundaries. It's quite clear whether or not a chapter of your book is verbatim identical to a chapter of mine. It's not clear whether the idea embodied in your machine is sort of a variant of the idea embodied in my machine. I gather there's someone at the moment who is claiming that he has a patent that covers all of Wi-Fi, and that therefore nobody should be allowed to use Wi-Fi without a license from him. And as some of you may know, that Samuel Morse attempted to patent the Internet. If you look at Morse's claims when he got the patent on the telegraph, his last claim, those of you who've had patent law know that when you apply for a patent, you make a bunch of different claims. And his last claim was always of using the electromagnetic force to transmit letters and symbols to a distance. All right, that covers the Internet, it covers radio, television, all sorts of things other than that. The court did not, in fact, give him that one. They thought it was a little overbroad. But it does indicate how fuzzy the boundaries are around the things the patent protects. And therefore, it makes a good deal of sense that patent law, in fact, is less generous about giving out property rights, in effect, than copyright law. Yes. And this is relevant if any of you have thought about the question of whether or not computer programs are copyrightable. But that was a real legal issue. Courts came down on both sides of it. Eventually, Congress intervened and modified the statute to say that they were covered. And the argument against is that a computer program, especially a computer program which exists not on a piece of paper, but burned into the read-only memory of a computer, is not a writing. A human being can't read it. If it's a machine language program, if he read it, he couldn't understand it. Therefore, as John Hersey, a novelist who was at the time head of the Patent and Copyright Office, Patent and Trade Secret Office, put it, a computer program is really an elaborate CAM. It's a piece of mechanism that controls a machine. Nonetheless, Congress decided that it should be copyrightable. And I think they were right, because if you ask not is it a writing, but does it have the characteristics that make property a sensible rule for writings, indeed a computer program has that same set of characteristics. So that's a place where I think the economics becomes interesting. Let me give you another issue on property, and I want now to go to what lawyers laughingly call real property, that is land, real estate. And the question is, if you own a piece of land, what do you own? Pretty clearly, if I start using shoulder-launched missiles to stop United Airlines from overflying my land, I'm exceeding my legitimate property rights. Equally, if I try to sue every radio and television broadcaster on the grounds that their electromagnetic signals are crossing my land without my permission, I'm also going to lose that case. And so that then suggests the broader, first it suggests the idea that what you really own when you say you own a piece of land is a bundle of rights with regard to that land. You have the right to forbid trespass, you have the right to forbid various other things, a lot of other rights you don't have. And so the question for a legal scholar or for an economist is, what determines what goes into that bundle? What are the things that belong in that form? And the economic answer is that the question to ask is, if I own this right, does that make me the person who is probably most values that right? So if you imagine that I own the right to grow crops on this land, that is not very useful if I don't have the right to go on the land.
it's of somewhat limited use if I don't have the right to keep other people from going on the land because they could trample my crops. On the other hand, the fact that a radio program is broadcasting across my land, the other way around, that's much more valuable to the broadcasters who are listening to them. In order for anybody to broadcast radio, it's like my earlier case of driving out my driveway. If the rule were that every landowner owns the right to ban radio waves crossing his property, then in order to set up a radio station, you would need unanimous permission from everybody within range. You'd never get it. We'd have no radio. So it makes more sense in that case to have the rule that we have, which is that's not included in my bundle, except I think if I can actually show damage. If the radio broadcast is right next to me and the signal is so intense, I don't know, I'm not sure if I can think of any ways it would work, but you can imagine at least that the signal is somehow messing up my land. And similarly, I don't have the right to enjoin any noise I can hear from my land, but if you set up loudspeakers that are blasting onto my land 24 hours a day, I bet I can get an injunction against you. So let me give you my favorite example of the fact that it isn't clear what belongs in the property in the bundle we call land, and that's the traditional land law of the state of Pennsylvania. As you may be aware, the state of Pennsylvania is made mainly out of coal. And the result is that I'm not sure this is still true, but it was the case that land ownership in Pennsylvania involved three different estates. That was how it was put. One of them was the surface estate, which is what we usually think of as the ownership of land, the right to build on it and go on it and forbid trespassers. One was the mineral estate, which was the right to dig out the coal underneath it. What do you think the third estate was? What would you like to own if you own the surface estate and somebody else owns the mineral estate? What might be of some interest to you? Whether or not your house is going to fall into his hole. All right? The third estate is the support estate. The support estate is the right to have the surface supported. So if I own the surface estate and the support estate and you own the mineral estate, you can mine coal under my land, but you've got to leave enough pillars of coal so that my surface doesn't subside. On the other hand, if I bought the surface estate but you kept the support estate, I had better not use that land for anything which would be a real catastrophe if it fell into a hole. Because I have no, at least again, that's traditional law, I'm not sure it's still true, I have no right to prevent that. So that's a case where, again, you can argue it makes some sense that in some cases the support estate is most valuable to the person who owns the surface. Obviously, there's a house there. On the other hand, if all I'm doing is grazing cattle there, it may not matter very much if occasionally there's some piece of my meadow falls into your mine, and it might be costly to you to leave enough pillars to keep it up. So that's sort of an interesting example. All right, let me go on to yet another question. You'll notice that I'm giving you a semester course in an hour, so therefore I've got to skip over an awful lot of stuff. If people are really curious about this, I have written a book on this subject, and it is available not only from better bookstores everywhere, which means Amazon.com, it's also available for free on the web if you look at my webpage. So let me take a different point, and one which I suppose only would occur to an economist, and that's what's wrong with theft anyway. Because after all, if our basic rule is size of the pie, when you pick my pocket and take $100, I'm $100 poorer, you're $100 richer, what's the problem? All right. The economist's answer is that if you have the opportunity to pick pockets, you're not going to find that that profession is free. That you will discover that if you are a burglar or a pickpocket, the victims don't like it, and therefore they take various precautions. Furthermore, you've got competitors. That if at little effort you can make $100 every time you like it, lots of people are going to want to do this. And those lots of people will mean there will be very few people left with $100 in their pocket to be picked. And if you think about it as an economist, you say, wait a minute, as long as just as in other fields, if one profession pays more than everything else, allowing for the cost of training and the risks and everything else, people will move into that profession. Doing that will drive down the return in that profession until they're equally attractive. Well, it works for crime, too, that if picking pockets makes you $20 an hour and McDonald's pays you whatever they optimistically say, $10 an hour, then pretty soon everybody who was going to work at McDonald's picks pockets instead, but their doing so results in pocket picking becoming less and less profitable, and that process continues until people are giving up a $10 an hour job at McDonald's to make $10.01 picking pockets, but the victim has still lost the $100. So therefore, at this point, the gain to the criminal is just about wiped out by the cost to the criminal of getting it, whereas on the other hand, the loss to the victim is not. So that suggests that there is a real cost to what we think of as criminal activities, to transferring property without the permission of the owner of the property, and therefore it makes sense to have rules that try to make it costly to do that, try to prevent it. The general term for that phenomenon is, we call it rent-seeking, meaning that if you have an opportunity to transfer from somebody else to yourself, and many people can do it, they will tend to enter that activity until they drive down its return to other things they could be doing with their time, at which point the victim is losing, but you're no longer gaining. And economists have argued that that applies to a large range of activities, for example, lobbying, that if you have the option to persuade the government to give your industry a bunch of money, lots of industries would like to do that, and you're going to end up spending quite a lot of money on contributions to congressional campaigns and the like in order to get your benefit. And you can think of other examples as well. Let me go on to a more general point which might have occurred to you when I raised the question of why there's anything wrong with theft. Because a lot of people's reaction would be not the argument I made, but to say, wait a minute, the thief isn't entitled to your $100, so therefore we should count your $100 gain, but not your $100 loss, but not his $100 gain. And from my standpoint, that is a mistake. It may not be a mistake in morality, but I'm not teaching morality. It's a mistake in economics or in law because it's assuming your conclusion. It's assuming you already know that theft is a bad thing. But we don't know, for example, that my using a word you invented is a bad thing, and yet that might be. You might think of that as theft if you're imagining words as potentially being property. I want to use my tools to figure out what are bad things, so to speak, to figure out what the rules should be, and if I assume the rules to start with, I'm not going to be able to do that. I'll just be assuming my conclusion. Presumably, I assume most of you believe in global warming. I think there's pretty good evidence for anthropogenic global warming. Nothing certain in this world. So it may have occurred to you that you're all criminals, because after all, you exhale carbon dioxide. And by exhaling carbon dioxide, you're causing global warming. So everyone in this room ought to feel guilty about the fact that he's causing sea levels to rise. And there are a few, not very many, but a few places in the world where people live so close to the sea that you might be flooding them out. And therefore, all right, that, it seems to me, suggests the fact that it's not enough to say my action imposes some cost, therefore the law should intervene. That if, as in that case, the individual action is imposing a tiny cost, very highly dispersed cost, it's not clear that there are legal mechanisms that can or should deal with it. So in any case, from my standpoint at least, figuring out what are crimes is supposed to be one of the things you're doing, not one of the things you know to start with. Let's think about looking at criminal law the same way I was looking at tort law a little earlier. And that is, you have a crime which imposes a cost on somebody and a benefit on the criminal, which is why he does it. And usually, our usual expectation is the things we call crimes are mostly things where we're pretty sure the cost is larger than the benefit. In particular, I steal your car. Why is the cost larger than the benefit? Because I could have bought the car if it was worth more to me than to you. It's only if it's worth less to me than to you that I only get it by stealing, in which case we don't want it back. But there are obviously exceptions. Posner offers the example of the hunter who was lost and starving in the woods. He comes across a locked cabin. Inside the cabin there are cans of food and a telephone hanging up on the wall. So he breaks and enters. He breaks into the cabin, feeds himself, and calls somebody to rescue him. And if he's an honest man, he finds out who owns the cabin and compensate him. But nonetheless, that looks like a crime. It's normally a crime, but it's a special case of what we would call an efficient crime, a crime where the benefit is greater than the cost. Similarly, you can imagine that you're speeding and the cop stops you and you point out that your wife is in labor in the back seat. And so the cop helps you get to the hospital as quickly as possible rather than giving you a speeding ticket. So that's another case where you're breaking the law, but you're breaking the law in a way that produces net benefits. And the question then is, how can you set up a legal system so that only efficient crimes happen and inefficient crimes don't happen? And the first instinct of the economist, well, there's one way, of course, is to special case it. One way to say we'll have legal doctrines if we can recognize, like the wife going into labor, or like the lost hunter, we have a doctrine whose name I've just forgotten, which says the lost hunter is not a criminal. Necessity, the doctrine of necessity, and other things of that sort. But there are going to be a lot of cases where we can't do that. You could imagine that the reason I'm speeding is not my wife going into labor in the back seat, but some need to get a particular place at a particular time, that I just broke up with the girlfriend who I now realize I really ought to marry, and if I don't get to her before she gets to the airport and flies across the country and goes accepting somebody else's proposal, I'll lose her forever. Maybe in that situation, the risk to other people of my driving at 80 miles an hour is worth it in terms of the importance of the gain to me, but there's no way I'm going to be able to show that to the cop. So that suggests the same rule as tort. Have a punishment which on average equals the damage done, and then let the individual criminals choose whether to accept that punishment. I say on average because you don't catch all criminals, they'd have to scale up the amount to allow for the fact that you only have 10% chance or whatever of inflicting it. And that sounds like a really neat argument, and there's certainly some element of truth to it, but you think about it a little more and you say, wait a minute. Does that mean that in a legal system, the reason the murder rate, that in a well-designed legal system, the reason the murder rate is not zero is that we think some of the murders are efficient murders, that killing you is worth more to me than it hurts you? And I don't think that describes what's really going on in the real world. And you then have to think about the fact that, wait a minute, I've been talking as if preventing inefficient crimes was costless. But it's not costless. In order to impose a certain probability of a certain punishment, we've got to hire cops, we've got to have prisons, we've got to bear various costs. Furthermore, when we punish you, since your value counts two to the economist, locking you up not only costs us the prison, it costs you your freedom and nobody gets that freedom. Or executing you costs you your life and nobody gets that. So that raises the question of not would we like to deter this crime, but how much would we like to deter this crime? Is it worth the cost, the extra cop that we'll need to reduce the rate of robbery from 99 to 98 or whatever? And if you look at my book, I go through in some detail how in principle you would do that calculation and figure out what the right punishment would be. And there would be some cases where you allow inefficient offenses to occur because it costs more to deter them than it's worth. If we have to spend $100 to prevent you from doing something that benefits you by $90 and hurts somebody by $95, well, my act had a net damage of $5, but preventing it has a net damage of $95 because it's too costly to prevent it. So that then raises one issue. This then gets me into another issue, and one which I find sort of intriguing, and that's why we have such inefficient punishments. And let me describe briefly my modest proposal for improving our criminal punishment system. It's very simple. We have some crime where we currently punish it with 10 years in prison. And by doing careful research, we discover that a criminal is indifferent to 10 years in prison or one chance in six of being executed. So I say, well, that simplifies things a whole lot. Every time we convict somebody, we roll a die. 1 to 5, we send him home. 6, we hang him. And this is neither better nor worse for the criminals, on average. Obviously, the one who got the 6 doesn't like it. But on average, by our assumption, the 1 in 6 risk of hanging is the equivalent to the criminal of 10 years in prison. And we don't have to pay for the prisons anymore. All right, save some money. We'll have the same deterrent effect, because it's the same effect to the criminals, so it won't affect the victims any. Isn't this an improvement? And then you go a little further. We can do better than this. What's the point of catching 5 guys and sending them home? We'll just fire cops until the percentage of people we catch is down by a factor of 6 and then hang all of them. And I actually had a published journal article which started out with why not hang them all. But we can even do better than that, of course, because once we start thinking about that seriously, we realize that hanging people is really very wasteful. After all, there's a shortage of organs for transplant. And therefore we start thinking about various ways in which you could make punishments more efficient. That you could say, well, you execute people, but first you dismember them for ideal circumstance for getting organs to transplant after all. Or you could say we will make people work their sentences off penal slavery. We'll use fines wherever we can because the fine really is just a transfer. You can think of a lot of ways of making the punishment more efficient. The question is, what's wrong with that idea? Because the logic, it sounds like, you know, it's an improvement. Why waste money on prisons? And I think, I'm not sure it was before or after I wrote my article, I discovered that a science fiction writer, Larry Niven, had actually seen the same problem that I spotted. And that is that we want to think about the incentives not only of the criminals, but also of the law enforcement system. And that if punishing people is very profitable, you may find lots of people to punish. Somebody online made this point to me when he said, when I was describing not this particular proposal, but a proposal which was designed to basically convert punishments from imprisonment to fines by letting people work off their punishments. And he said, yeah, the colonial powers in Africa had that system. When they wanted a road built, they found some excuse to arrest a bunch of the natives, and their punishment was working on building the road. And it struck me that that was a very real point. And what Larry Niven's story is a story which starts out a little bit after the story was really written, with one country after another getting this idea that if you're going to execute people, you might as well have their organs forfeit for transplant. But, of course, the next result is there's still a shortage of organs. Well, we know how to solve that problem. Obviously, we have to increase the number of capital crimes. And at the end of the short story, which is where Niven presented it, you discover that the protagonist who's in jail awaiting execution has been convicted of, for the third time, driving in such a way as to endanger human life. So three dangerous driving convictions, three strikes, and you're out. So Niven had seen the problem, which is you have to think, if you're going to do this right, about the incentives of the enforcers as well as the enforcees. And that from that standpoint, the virtue of inefficient punishments is that at least you don't have much incentive to impose them on people who haven't done anything or haven't done very much. And of course, this is a problem that's a live political issue in the U.S. Well, it's a live issue in the tort case because people worry about class actions and punitive damages. They worry that people will sue not because someone has done something wrong but in order to get money. And they ought to worry about it in the context of civil forfeiture because, as some of you may know, under civil forfeiture laws, the cops can claim a piece of property not on the grounds that the owner broke the law but that the property broke the law. They do not have to. First, it's a civil case, so it's only preponderance of the evidence. Second, they do not have to demonstrate that the owner knew that the property was being used for something illegal, just that the property was used for something illegal. We could discuss that if people are curious, but that obviously has an incentive effect. And in particular, there is some evidence that it resulted in sizably shifting what cops spent their time doing in the direction of looking for ways of confiscating property rather than ways of actually enforcing the law, because that is the police department, in effect, gets at least a large share of the confiscated property. All right, I guess I'll tell you my story. This is why I have several medieval Islamic law and econ stories. And this one is about the incentive to enforce the law. The poet Ibn Harma performed before the prince of the Muslims, the caliph. And so delighted was the prince of the Muslims with his performance that he said, "Name your reward." And Ibn Harma said, "The reward I wish is that you send instructions to your officials in the city of Medina, commanding that when I am found dead drunk upon the pavement and brought in by the city guard, I be let off from the punishment prescribed for that offense." And the prince of the Muslims said, "That is God's law, not mine. I cannot change it. It's Quranic law. Name another reward. There is nothing else I desire from the prince of the Muslims." So the caliph thought a little, and he sent instructions to his officials in the city of Medina, commanding that if anyone found the poet Ibn Harma drunk upon the pavement and brought him in, Ibn Harma should receive 40 strokes of the lash, as the law commanded. But whoever brought him in should receive 80. And ever after, when anyone saw the poet drunk upon the pavement, he would turn to his companion and say, 80 for 40 is a poor bargain. It's a great story, in part because the caliph was faced with the fact that under Islamic legal doctrine, he doesn't get to make the law. The law is made by God, in effect. But that's all right. That's all right. He gets to control the enforcement of the law, which is enough. We're a little short on time, but let me say a little bit about the relation between crime and tort. I've got a chapter on this. Because in some sense, they're ways of doing the same thing. All right? You do something bad to someone, something bad happens to you, so you don't do bad things to people. That's sort of a simple description of both. And that raises the interesting question, are there good reasons to have both systems? Are there good reasons why certain things are treated as crimes and certain things as torts? And are there good reasons why criminal law has one set of legal rules and tort law another set of legal rules? And I've sort of hinted at possible answers to some of those questions in earlier things I said, but it's really quite a large and interesting question, which I think people in law school don't think about as much as they should. Let me say a little bit about the question of economics and justice, because one of the things that no doubt some people find offensive about the economic approach is that we're not asking what's just, we're only asking what's efficient, or maybe not even that, just what are the consequences of certain rules. And one of the intriguing things about it is that when you try to figure out what an efficient set of legal rules is, quite a lot of your ideas of justice come out the other end. That is to say, if you put in essentially a value free, or if the only value is maximizing the size of the pie, say, it then turns out that many of the things that you thought you believed in for moral reasons are rules which in fact do increase the size of the pie. And that would be a long discussion, but it's interesting. It's not clear why that's true, whether our morals really are just internalized efficiency rules or whether there's some deeper connection. Let me say a little bit about the relationship between legal theory and economics as subjects of study, as it were. One of the neat things about economics is that it's all one thing. That is to say, once you've really learned price theory, which is miscalled microeconomics in a lot of courses, you have the tools to think about all economic questions. And the rest is really just applications of that to a wide range of different fields. Whereas my impression, I haven't been a law school student, unlike all of you, but I've taught lots of law school students. Watch them, and my impression is that when you finish learning criminal law and you start learning evidence, you start over again at the beginning. And when you finish that and you start learning conflict of laws, you start over again at the beginning. That law, as far as I can tell, doesn't really have a single unifying set of ideas in the sense in which economics or maybe physics or some other fields do. And that therefore, part of the attraction of the economic approach to law is that it gives you a unifying theory. It gives you a way of saying, once we understand the reasons for this rule over here, aha, that explains the reasons for that rule over there. And that's sort of tempting, but it's also sort of threatening, because a different way of putting it is the economist is coming to the legal scholar and saying, oh, by the way, you can't really do your field until you learn mine. So that's a sense in which we're imperialists threatening the claim to a certain intellectual territory of a bunch of our competitors. On the other hand, I don't want to treat it as if it was only one way, because in fact economists have gained a great deal from studying the law as well as the other way around, because economics tends to think of things like property and contract as if they were simple ideas. And when you start looking sort of where the rubber meets the road at the attempt of legal systems to actually concretize these ideas, you suddenly start realizing that they're much, much more complicated concepts and raise a whole lot more issues than you would have thought. And that results in improving economics. And in fact, one of the most important economic articles of the past 100 years was an article written by Ronald Coase, which is about half the reason he got a Nobel Prize in economics. And it was really a result of his looking at the law and seeing that certain economic views, which had been accepted by everybody since about the 1930s, really were wrong. And that you could restate the problem in a way which showed that the conventional approach sometimes gave the wrong answer, sometimes the right answer, and gave a better approach. This is Coase basically against Pigou, the guy I mentioned earlier. There's a famous story, famous at University of Chicago at least, that Coase came to give a talk on his ideas at Chicago. And he had dinner at the house of Aaron Director, who was the first editor of the Journal of Law and Economics. And there were, I don't know, 14 or 15 economists there, of whom like five later got, I'm making up the numbers, but some four or five later got Nobel Prizes. And when the dinner started, the argument was 15-1 against Coase, that everybody else thought Pigou's view, which had been the accepted view in the field for 60 years, 50 years or something, was right. And when the argument, when the dinner was over, it was 16-0 in favor of Coase. So that was sort of an interesting case, and basically that was in part the result of his having studied law and tried to think about the application. All right, all of this is obviously a very brief sketch of the subject. If you want more, my webpage is www.daviddfriedman.com. That's IED, Friedman. And I've got a link there to Law's Order, which is the book-length version of what I've just been doing, or you could be extravagant and buy a copy. Either of those is available. Any questions? Everything is clear as pea soup? Thank you.